Today with Claire Byrne on RTÉ Radio 1, sponsored by Sullis. Finish school and not sure what's next? Explore further education and training options at thisisfet.ie.
Confirmation this morning from the family of Rory Mason that the 23-year-old from Dunboyne in County Meath was killed in action while fighting for the International Legion for the Defence of Ukraine a few days ago on the 28th of September. This news comes as we hear about the dramatic and rapid advances Ukraine's military are making against Russian forces in the past week, taking dozens of towns in the regions in the south and the east. Well, I'm joined now from Ukraine by Kim Sengupta, who's defence and diplomatic editor with the London Independent, and also Sviatoslav Yurash, Ukrainian MP. And Sviatoslav, I want to start with you because we're hearing this morning about the sad news of the death of a young Irish man, Rory Mason. I know you want to pay tribute to him and many others who've helped your country since the war began.
Rory certainly will take his place in the pantheon of heroes who have brought our country in the challenges of the 21st century. It's very clear that people like Rory have answered the call that the free world has made in this day and age, not expecting that what we hope for, that never is possible, that is to Great War in Europe is happening again, and he was the one coming to battle against the onslaught that Russia has incurred onto Ukraine and all of the free world. And we will forever thank him and his family and the whole Irish nation for doing everything you are doing to help us in this greatest time of need.
And Sviatoslav, are you still calling on people from other countries to join the war effort despite the clear dangers that they face?
Very clear that when fighting against the biggest country on earth that has prepared for the entirety of the Cold War, for the Third World War, and is using all of its arsenals to try and destroy our nation, and all the help is needed from all around the world. So we are still very much calling on the citizens of the world to join us in this fight in many different ways that they can.
Tell me a little bit about what's been happening, because we're hearing here that President Zelensky says that the army is making fast and powerful progress. What do you know about those advances?
I've seen them firsthand. I returned from the front lines barely a month ago, my rotation ending. I am a mobilized soldier as well as member of parliament. And I have fought in the Don trenches of the east of Ukraine against the Russians. The fact on the ground is that Russians are still trying to push, and we have prepared for month and month, and we have pushed back at them. To the great awe from the world, which is seeing as the country that is 16 times smaller than Russia is still beating back that army and showing the world the reality of the fight that democracies can still take to autocracies that are bent on destroying them. And basically, as we continue our advance in the east, and we step by step are taking the battle to the Russians in the south, we are showing that we are coming to what is needed here. That is a restoration of integrity of Ukraine and therefore the world.
Okay, Sviatoslav, stay with us because I want to bring in Kim Sengupta, Defence and Diplomatic Editor with the London Independent. And Kim, thank you for joining us. What's your own assessment of what has been happening in recent days and weeks?
Well, I'm in Kharkiv at the moment, and I've been to some of the liberated towns and villages in the northeast, in places like Lyman, Izium, etc. Now, they have been taken, but that doesn't mean they're all entirely secure. I was in a place called Kupiansk yesterday when we came under quite heavy shelling. A convoy, a civilian convoy, trying to leave Kupiansk last week, came under shell fire, and 21 people, including 11 children, were killed. So although, you know, these areas have been taken back by the Ukrainians, it doesn't mean they're all safe. There is still fighting, albeit at range, going on now. And, you know, we'll have to see, you know, how things progress or otherwise.
And tell me a little bit about what's happening on the Russian side, because we see reports that when it comes to the partial mobilisation, 200,000 men have come forward and have been called up. The call was for 300,000, wasn't it?
It was for 300,000 initially. I mean, they have, on paper at least, got a a reserve strength of 25 million. Now, they haven't been able to fulfill the first tranche, 300,000, yet. And as you know, you've had hundreds of thousands who have fled the country. The estimates vary from between 250,000 to 350,000. You know, they have gone into countries where there is a visa-free regime with Russia, like Georgia, etc. So, you know, people are voting with their feet.
Mm-hmm. And tell me a little bit about how the Russian forces then that are in place, how they've been performing in the face of the Ukrainian advances.
Well, it's interesting, you know, how it's unfolded. I mean, I was in the Donbass in June, July, when the Ukrainians were taking, you know, quite heavy losses. You know, they were losing, according to estimates, between 100 and 200 a day. I was in Severodonetsk and Lysychansk two times just before they fell to the Russians, and the morale was very low. The Russians had taken Lyman, which meant that Slovyansk, one of the biggest cities in the Donbass, was under threat. And I must admit that when we left the Donbass in July, many of us thought that the Russians would go through and take the rest of the region, but that hasn't happened. And as we know, the Ukrainians have now retaken Lyman, which means the Slovyansk is safer. The Russians are carrying on attacks on another town called Bakhmut, where I'll be going to next. But for the time being, certainly the Russians have been pushed back in the Donbass. And it's certainly the case that one of the main reasons for that has been the supply of Western weaponry, things like HIMARS and the MLRS, which have been very, very effective against the Russians.
Sviatoslav, do you agree with that assessment, that one of the main reasons for Ukrainian success is the supply of Western weapons?
Yes, that is very helpful, as well as the fact that we have been basically mobilizing and regrouping our forces to try and face whatever Russians are throwing our way in the east. And the towns that the other gentleman was mentioning was exactly what I fought. Near Bakhmut is what I fought, and the reality there was horrifying every single day. But the fact of the matter is, we have plenty of reserves that we are calling up on to try and replace anything that Russia is destroying on their attempts to try and take over Donbass. But they are clearly failing at that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we say that you're making advances, but as Kim has explained, there is pushback happening. The Russians are not just taking this. Some are leaving and fleeing, but others are not. And the shelling continues. It's still a very dangerous situation in many parts of the Donbass.
Indeed, the fact of the matter is, whatever Western support, the Russians have much more stuff, much lower quality, and it's much less precise, but it's plentiful, and they were shelling our positions, and many of my friends died there.
Kim, can I ask you whether there has been any indication of unusual activity surrounding Moscow's nuclear arsenal since the latest nuclear threats were made by Vladimir Putin?
Well, the impact has really been psychological rather than anything we can see where we are on the ground. I mean, you'll have a better perspective of what's going on, you know, away from this area. But obviously, you know, Mr. Putin has raised the nuclear threat implicitly and latterly explicitly in a number of times. And of course, if there is a nuclear strike, and so far we've certainly seen nothing on the ground around here to suggest there will be, then this is the kind of area, Kharkiv, you know, the northeast, which will may be affected. So people are obviously aware of that. You know, they are concerned. You know, there are lots of searches online on what to do if a nuclear attack takes place. But, you know, we simply don't know. I mean, it does seem utterly unthinkable that there should be a nuclear war anywhere, especially in the heart of Europe, perhaps, in 2022. But, you know, the whole war has been unexpected, so people are apprehensive.
Tell us a little bit more, Kim, about where you're going today and what you expect to see there.
Well, I'll be going to Donbass later on today. I came back from that town to the Kharkiv Oblast quite late last night. And as I said, you know, some areas have been secured, others have been secured, but are not entirely safe. And of course, you know, part of the problem is that a lot of the bridges have been blown by both sides to stop others from getting through. So just moving around is extremely difficult, and that also means that essential supplies like, you know, food and water hasn't got through to many of these towns like Kupiansk, Liman, etc. And they're getting through now, and you know, so they've got a humanitarian issue, you know, quite a dire one there as well. And the other, you know, the big problem is of course, you know, the winter approaching fast, and there is a lack of fuel. There are huge power cuts in parts of this region, and people are obviously very, very worried about, you know, what's going to happen in the winter with the heating possibly off.
Sviatoslav, can you confirm that? I know part of your own efforts involved organising humanitarian supply lines. Are you still doing that? Are you particularly concerned about the east now?
After I returned from the front lines and for rotation and a grouping of our units, I have resumed the humanitarian work. I've been just been to the east south, to around Kherson, and the situation there basically is very dire, because the fact on the ground is that Russians, beside all the horrors of occupation, are essentially destroying any ability for the supply lines that the locals need, both in terms of medicine, food, in terms of everyday necessities that everybody has to try and realize them. So the point is the work on trying to keep the supply lines open and keep the civilians and the military well provided for is exactly the job right now.
And with the winter coming, is that concern very real about a lack of fuel?
That is most clearly most pressing request that I've had from all the military people I've met in terms of winter clothes, winter, everything for the preparation for the winter. And getting enough of everything that everybody is asking for is almost an impossibility. But we are having those conversations and those deals being made with our allies from the West that are allowing us to try and provide for all those civilian and military needs.
But despite these problems that you face, and you outline them very clearly, this must be a positive moment with these advances happening.
Most certainly, but again, it is a step, but certainly the final step. Russian mobilization is a very serious challenge because the numbers the Russians can put on the field is certainly something to be very worried about. But we are making the same preparations to try and face off that challenge. And Russians are clearly not providing, in terms of organization, the capabilities to try and realize those numbers in action. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is they are willing to put many, many more thousands of their own people into a meat grind of their own making. And we have no other choice but to beat them back and try and face whatever they throw our way.
Kim, how effective are those soldiers who've been called up through mobilization? We've heard about the fact that they're reluctant, that they're inexperienced, often with little training. But by virtue of the fact that they have very many numbers or are likely to have very many numbers, is that in itself going to mean that they're effective?
Well, it will mean they'll be effective up to an extent of having boots on the ground. And of course, you know, if you compare the West's wars, one of the big problems, for example, with Afghanistan was that, you know, apart from a very brief periods, the West never really had enough boots on the ground. But so in purely military terms, having more soldiers is a plus factor. But this is not Afghanistan. You know, this is a very modern war being fought. This is a war being fought basically through equipment, with artillery mainly, you know, with drones, with tanks to an extent, and just having large numbers of badly trained and badly armed soldiers would not be a huge factor. Now, what we have seen in the east, more than the south perhaps, is that the Russian troops are, a lot of them are from the separatist republics, from the DNR and LNR, the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics. You know, they are worse armed and worse trained than their Russian counterparts. And, you know, with the winter coming, they'll be worse clothed as well. So they will have the numbers, but, you know, I don't think the numbers alone would be a deciding factor in this conflict. I mean, what happened, as we know, is that the Russians moved some of their better troops from the east to the south to counter an Ukrainian offensive there. The Ukrainians then very cleverly struck to the northeast and have made these gains. So, you know, the Russians had hollowed out the northeast when the Ukrainians came in here, and they will be reinforcing this vacuum. But in the meantime, you know, they've lost a lot of territory. They've lost, you know, essential supply places like Kupiansk, you know, military strongholds like Izium and Liman. So, you know, they've got an awful lot of ground to make up for before winter sets in.
Okay, well, thank you both. Kim Sengupta from the London Independent and Ukrainian MP Sviatoslav Yurash. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.